It's time for Valley Edition, a weekly panel discussion on current issues in the Mat-Su Valley, moderated by Mike Malevsky.
Well, folks, once again, it's time for another edition of Valley Edition. And we have here in the studio, Zaz Hollander. Welcome, Zaz.
Thanks.
And we have also in the studio, Terry Snyder. Welcome, Terry.
Good morning, all.
And on the phone today, all the way from Wasilla, Alaska, Mark Kelsey. Welcome, Mark.
Woohoo. Good morning, Mike, Terry, and Zaz.
And I'd like to start with Zaz here, and let's see where we're going with that, and then we'll move on to another ongoing story of interest. Yes.
And this is actually an ongoing story as well, and it affects Butte and Sutton, and it's of Matanuska River erosion. Meanwhile, over in Neutok, on the Bering Sea coast, decades of erosion. Basically, long story short, the Neutok Village Council has been trying for several years and actually got FEMA funding to move their village to a new site they've established about 9 miles away. And the state had been working with the village. The state is sort of the pass-through agency. They're the actual grantee. And there are a number of factors underlying the story, and it's more complicated than a long story short situation. One of them is a change in the makeup of the council in Neutok and a new direction in terms of where they wanted to go with moving homes versus tearing them down and building new ones. And a lot of state agencies involved. I think a lot of miscommunication involved. As sort of a rural-urban issue going on with communication. But long story short, the state in July told Neutok they were not going to get their money after all because their application for FEMA aid was incomplete. And instead it was going to the next recipient on the list, the communities of Butte and Sutton. The Mat-Su Borough had put in an application, a long-standing application that had been unsuccessful for several years to get FEMA money to buy out homes in danger of erosion along the Matanuska River. It's a little under $3 million, it sounds like.
Right.
And there are at least one of the homeowners in the river has gotten notice from the borough that his home, his property, is one of those under consideration. There are a little under 20 people, I believe, on the list, property owners on the list, for buyouts. And it remains to be seen how that money is going to be spent, how far it will go, when it's going to come.
So they don't, when they put the request in for the funding, did they at that time identify what houses would go with a dollar amount that they would need to do it?
They have a list of people who have agreed to be part of the buyout. And then if you remember, there are certain holdouts, some Usuals being one, who have said, you know, heck no, in stronger words. Mm-hmm. We don't want to be bought out. We want you to help us stay on the river. Mm-hmm. And there are other fixes that could be done to help. Sort of along the lines of the fixes DOT has done to save the highways, to save the Old Glen and Glen highways, but that money can't be spent to save private property. And so that's kind of the rub. There is both in Neutok and in on the Mat River, I think most government agencies around the country are of a mind that we don't want to spend a lot of money saving homes that are going to get washed or swept away at some point in the future. Mm-hmm. A much smarter, cheaper strategy is to get people off those areas.
Saz, I was just curious whether you had any information relative to the, I think, controversy, different views about the process used toward the end of the time allotted to Neutok, because that seemed to be a key piece there with the federal people saying they were working closely, trying to get that village to complete their application with something as simple, or what appeared to be as simple, as the valuation of the home, new homes that were going to be constructed, and they were really close but didn't do it. It just feels like, who was at fault there? Was it the lack of communication? The two bodies didn't talk, or anything?
Yeah, I mean, I think part of it was problems. Maybe not a lack of communication, but problems communicating. I think that there was a kind of a real push and pull between the state and the village council in terms of what was wanted. You know, it's one of those situations. I haven't been to Neutok. I think that it would take a really direct understanding of the personalities involved. But certainly the community of Neutok feels betrayed by the state and feels as if the state was actively working against them on this on this application.
Mark, do you have any comment?
I have questions. I'm curious if any of the current properties included in the prospective buyouts have been a part of any previous buyout program.
Here.
Well, I mean, if there were successful buyouts, then that's done. I mean, there have been years past, there have been a number of buyouts.
I'm talking about people who turned down previous offers.
Oh, yeah, I think there are certainly names on that list now who in the past had refused. Yeah.
I know there was a few years ago, there was a suggestion made by staff at the borough of taking some type of grant money and moving everybody and kind of developing a new subdivision from them with borough land. So to put them on, have a builder build houses instead of actually giving them money for their homes, just reinvesting that. And that got suggested and immediately pushed away.
Yeah, so. That isn't happening. And neither is some kind of an erosion no build zone, which normally comes with these buyouts, is that there's planning and overlay. It says, look, we bought these places out. You can't build here anymore. And
so
the borough can't
do
that.
Yeah.
The borough could do that. The borough is choosing not to do that, in part because mapping an erosion zone, I think mapping flood zones is difficult enough given how erratic flooding is anymore and climate change. And 100-year floods are happening every year now. But erosion is more difficult to map because it's a predictive, as is flooding. I've talked to Alex Strawn at the borough, and he said, do we go all the way to, on the other side of the old Glen Highway? Is that the erosion control zone? Who is in that zone? How far do we take it?
But could they say not these specific properties because they're buying them out?
I think they can put some kind of a covenant on those properties, yeah. And I think that is part of the buyout process legally.
Did you have another question, Mark?
No.
Okay, good.
Well covered.
Yes, nicely done, Silas. Well, let's move on to a controversy which is out there. I have just more recently read an Alaska Dispatch News piece that ran through a day-by-day look, looked at what the drug is. And we're talking about the Iditarod controversy, tramadol, what it is, what it does. Many people have seen the video that Dallas Eavy put out. We have had on our own station a regular program, Mushing Radio, and Robert Forteau and his co-host have discussed this, and their conclusion about relative possibilities of what actually happened was that none of this, if any of those possibilities were true, is a good thing for the Iditarod.
Mushergate.
Right.
Yeah.
Zaz, once again, what's going on?
Well, a good question, and I think that's the heart of this mystery is nobody knows except whoever done it. And Dallas Seavey is adamant that he did not give his dogs tramadol, which is basically it's a painkiller. And we spent some time yesterday trying to track down different experts, veterinary experts, on what this stuff would do to dogs. Dallas and his supporters have been assuring the public, and with good intent as far as we know, that tramadol, it has sedative side effects. And why would you give a dog in the middle of, at the tail end of a race, a very close race, after 1,000 miles, why would you want to sedate your dogs? We talked to a number of vets who said, well, it isn't, it isn't. It can also give them a boost. It can mask pain. It can make them run better than they did before. And this is in no way implicating Dallas Seavey, but we just wanted to try to get the facts out about that particular drug because so few people know what it is, especially in the context of sled dog racing. But yes, I mean, the issue, I think the broader issue that Robert Forteau and others are raising is either you have a musher who doped his dogs, and again, there's no proof that any of that happened, or you have an insecure environment in which dogs are allowed to be doped.
Yeah.
I mean, it's possible that whole team would have tested positive for tramadol. They only test four. So it's not just four dogs out of the seven he came in with. It's four dogs that were tested. So it's possible these dogs got into it. It's possible that somebody dropped their bottle of tramadol in the dog. It's a really bitter drug.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, if it's in a piece of meat or something like that, it would be. And again, no proof that happened either.
So. Well, aside from the specifics of who did this, the second and what is emerging as maybe a larger question is the way in which the ITC has handled this process. Because Dallas Seeby has said, hey, you guys didn't do this well. I want to work with you. And the ITC has released from time to time a different press release. Speak to that.
I think that there's a rule in public relations that you get out ahead of a problem. Mm-hmm. And Iditarod Trail Committee certainly did not do that here. And I think for years they've been allowed to kind of operate in this insular environment. Well, we're up here in Alaska. It's a sled dog race. It's a pretty well-funded race. I mean, there's all these comments about this shoestring budget. And Iditarod does not release its figures publicly, so we don't know how much money is coming in. But, you know, the top officials are making six figures. So it's not a shoestring budget necessarily. And I think that they've been allowed to operate without national scrutiny until things like this happen. And then, you know, the World Sled Dog Racing Association comes out and says this group is not affiliated with our organization, is not handling this well.
Okay. Mark, any questions?
Well, and that's definitely the bigger point. As unfortunate as all of the confusion is over who did it or if it happened, how it happened, the bigger thing is keeping it from happening again. Is there any talk? Is the committee, you know, talking about changing rules or changing controls in any way?
Well, the only...
It seems like an easy enough thing to monitor more closely.
I think, and Tegan Hanlon is our reporter in Anchorage, who is our Iditarod reporter, and she maybe could answer this better. The only rule change I'm aware of goes to mushers who are caught doping, or dogs who are caught doped, I should say, making it more of a burden on the musher to prove he didn't do it, which does not address what you're addressing, Mark. I think
right.
Iditarod would say we already have controls in place at checkpoints to protect dogs, to protect food supplies. Mm. We saw, not this year, but the last year that they did not for drop dogs, that a number of drop dogs died in Iditarod's care, which is a whole other problem, but does speak to the protocols they have in place.
And, of course, what's happening now is that organizations, including some kind of umbrella organization of dog-powered sports, as well as PETA and others, are saying, oh, okay, this is another example that the Iditarod doesn't know how to do this kind of thing.
And PETA's going to do that at any time anything happens. But I think some of the athletic associations, the Iditarod Finishers Committee,
right.
What about 80
right.
finishers?
Right.
That's I think, a bigger problem.
And coming up right immediately is the 2018 race, where you already have Dallas dropping out, one other musher from outside dropping out, and then a third musher dropping out for an unrelated issue. And the question remains, will this be enough to cause a large group of people to either boycott or request more transparency, and et cetera?
I think Mitch Seeby is considering it. But I mean, I'm hearing talk of let's bring the Iditarod back to what it used to be. You know, Stan Hooley is taking some heat for talking about how corporate, the sponsors, you know, the money behind the race and how that needs to, the race needs that to survive. And there's a push to make Iditarod the race it used to be, which was more about running dogs from village to village.
So, how can that possibly happen?
It won't. Unless you start a new race.
Roll back is hard. Terry, do you have any comments?
Yeah, we all long for those Harriet Ozzie days, you know, Harriet and Ozzie. There's no national CDC for veterinary medicine, is there, or like that? I think there's that.
There's a National Veterinary Medicine Association.
Curious about that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think I like what you had to say about the rule of thumb getting out in front of a problem. And I'm wondering whether there was some inklings of a problem when we got news, or the borough got news, that Wells Fargo had pulled out as a major sponsor. And I wonder if this talk has been going on sort of behind the scenes, and they got a heads up this was happening. And decided to back away from this controversy. They're full of their own. Their hands are full, pretty much, with their own controversy and banking. But I just wondered if I think that's really important. The fact that's what's missing here is the proaction of what's maybe their own board rules or whatever has bind them to not do the right thing. I don't know.
Yeah, I know that Wells Fargo decision was also around the time of the documentary Sled Dogs that was premiering in, I think, in Whistler or somewhere that, right. about that time and was not showing Iditarod in a good light.
Well, speaking about efforts to repeal something that has happened, I'd like to shift focus to Juneau. Briefly, as brief as I can, last year SB 91 was passed as a kind of comprehensive change to criminal justice. And there's been pushback. And so much so that we have a special session which is right now embroiled in a discussion about repeal, fix a little bit, or replace with SB 54. This earlier today, Palmer's police chief was in, and during an interview there, I did ask what his opinion was. I think it's safe to summarize by saying repealing would be a really, really difficult thing. It's appealing as a simple solution to something, much like repealing the Affordable Care Act. You just take it away. But the question of what happens, the whiplash effect of going back to a whole series of changes in the laws, et cetera. So the question remains is, what's going to happen? Will there be a little bit of tweaking? Will this pushback be heard and continuing to be heard as information is gathered about the effect SB 91 has had? Are we talking about things that are really beyond SB 91? You mentioned the opioid crisis. We have a downturn in the economy. We have a whole series of things going on that may have changed the environment within which SB 91 is operating. Mark, let's start with you.
That is very true, and it's part of the problem. You talk about how to quantify the effect of SB 91, and it's only been in effect for a year or so. Folks in other states who have applied it, folks who are in favor of this, say it needs more than a year to even get any kind of accurate feedback on it. So there's great temptation now, especially with, you know, crime associated with, say, the opioid crisis. It's tempting to just blame everything on SB 91, but the truth is it's not that simple. So I think in the end, a full repeal is not wise. A piecemeal fix seems like a better deal to me.
Okay, Terry?
Yeah, I would totally concur. I mean, this is just a reaction to pain. The economy, the pain of what's happened to the economy, of the legislature not, you know, continuing to keep driving this car into the ditch and nobody standing up and being the adult in the room and facing the fact that revenues need to be diversified and we have to start looking at people stepping up to the table with some type of income tax or some type of revenue change. Political purpose is driving the bus and it's driving it right into the road. That's where this SB 91 came out. It got sort of jammed through on the Senate side, and it was a bunch of it was the beginning of when we were starting to feel the effects of the economy going down, and it's only gotten worse. And now people are feeling the pain of those things that you've both put out there, and they want something done. And it's really very common for people to want to turn the wheel too fast, and to go into the slide is a better way to do it. And I think that way of doing things is to look at to modify it. And I hope that cooler minds prevail and that's what happens. But who knows? I mean, you would think they've been in Juneau this long this year that they would come to some solution, but I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think, Zaz?
Zaz, comment?
Oh, I don't know if they're going to come to us. I think that they're that Mark and Terry are making great points, and I don't have a lot to add to that, but that there's a whole pretrial component to the law that hasn't had a chance to go into effect yet. Mm. But there also has been enough time to start seeing smaller problems that probably do take a tweak to help them. I heard one analysis saying that the change in misdemeanor theft amount, which has apparently led to some increase in shoplifting, a lot of those people have substance abuse problems, and if they don't have to go to jail for even 5 days, that's a good thing. That they really don't want to go to jail, because then they can't have drugs. Mm-hmm. And so that's a real deterrent for some of this low-level crime. If that can be tweaked and fixed, I think that would, I mean, that level of crime is what most people are seeing on the streets. And that's what's really that kind of revolving door or no arrest at all. But there is also, I think, a self-fulfilling prophecy where, we're hearing there's some people in law enforcement who aren't arresting people because they don't expect them to get charged, that they won't be prosecuted. And so they're saying that to the public, like, we can't even arrest these people because of SB 91. Well, no, you're choosing not to arrest them based on an assumption that may or may not have anything to do with SB 91, but it's feeding into this public perception that there's more crime because of SB 91.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Good point.
Well, and it's worth noting there, too, that the police unions are opposed to SB 91, so there could be a little politicking going on there, too.
Yeah, think? Politicking?
Well, let's bring the focus now back to the Valley here. This week, there were a few meetings that happened. One that was, I thought, very interesting was the joint meeting that Terry attended that involved the Assembly and the Planning Commission. A couple of things came out of that. Terry, do you want to mention?
To me, the most interesting one was Mayor North Star Borough Mayor Carl Castle, who came down to give the body, and it was almost everybody was there. I think they were lacking one planning commissioner. A little talk on how rough the road has been traveled for the city of Fairbanks trying to get out of problems with the EPA about their air quality. I know I sat down not knowing that it's really been a 30-year battle, that even at the beginning, Fairbanks was struggled to get out of noncompliance because of their car emissions. And they finally got that under control just to have everybody and their population go up to the point where it was a wood stove problem. And so they have been battling it back. And he was very honest, gave them a very good timeline about exactly what had happened over those years. He's been around for a long time. Everybody knows that. And the millions of dollars literally have been spent trying to figure this problem out, and the weaving in and out of voter initiatives to block any type of regulation has really resulted in the city of Fairbanks really finally starting to dig themselves out. They're sort of similar with us at this point, where Palmer has some air quality problems. It's not near what it is in the Butte. The same thing with the borough. Their air quality in the city of Fairbanks is getting better, but in the outlying areas, it's still a struggle.
Isn't North Pole at times found to have like the worst air quality in the world?
Yeah.
Worse than China?
Yeah, so they've gotten his message in short to the borough was be tough and start being tough early. You may not make it this year. It's very, very, very possible that by January, the Matsu borough will be in noncompliance of EPA. And if you are waiting around for the federal government to change its regulations so that you're not in trouble, I wouldn't hold my breath, is what he said. At this point in time, they did a stove buyback program. They did tons of education. They've done tons of education. He admittedly says they didn't do enough community engagement in getting the public on board to what the problem was. But at this point, if you want to put a wood stove in North Star Borough, you have to pay a $350 permit from the borough to get it. You have to buy it. A stove from a registered stove builder. You have to take a class, and you have to prove you have a woodshed to keep dry wood. So they're not messing around in Fairbanks anymore. And he said a lot of people are. He spends his day, and kudos to him, when they have 7 people on staff doing nothing but non-compliance and wood stove.
It's like twice the code compliance officers the whole borough.
Right. And he says he himself, when he gets one of the particular people call him, or the city notifies them, or the borough notifies them, they're getting ready to do something about non-compliance, he picks up a phone and talks to them directly. And he pointed out that he knows that Mr. Halter, Vern Halter, doesn't like to make phone calls, but he said it's worth it. He goes, I call him, and I help, offer to tell him what the problem is. He goes, and I offer to show them how they can get in compliance, how it'll benefit themselves by drying, you know, burning dry wood, and what the effects are. And he goes, and I have to tell you, 9 out of 10 of those calls, people are grateful. And they're grateful that we're giving them a chance to make things right. So lots of great lessons there. And whether the borough takes those lessons or not is remains to be seen.
Very interesting. Yeah. There was another smoke-related topic at this meeting. It had to do with marijuana?
Oh, yeah, the marijuana meeting. Yeah, that was pretty interesting, too. Yeah, newsflash, we're making money off of marijuana, even though we've restricted it about as much as at this point in a lot of in the city of Palmer, within the city limits of Wasilla, but they are making money on it. There are some things to be fixed. The setback, and of course, is one of the things that's high on people's minds. And so it was a good, it's kind of an update sort of a thing. I was sort of surprised to find out there were only one laboratory in Wasilla, or in the valley, and also
testing lab.
One testing lab, right, and no manufacturers, I think.
There's a possible in Talkeetna.
Yeah.
Joe, the guy who owns the High Expedition, wants to start one.
Okay.
So, there is some concern. There was some calls. He talked about the on-site consumption that's coming up from the marijuana board, and there was some concern by some of the Planning Commission members on how that was going to work in some of the residential areas.
Did he talk about the cultivation facility in Willow?
Nope.
It's an open air, and it,
yes.
it's the yep. smell is
yep.
very clear
yep.
and present driving on the Parks
yep.
Highway.
Yep, that's right. Thanks for reminding me of that, Zaz. Yeah, that is going to have to be something on the radar, too, something like that.
Okay.
Pretty interesting.
Well, on that note, I think we've come to the end of another edition of Valley Edition. And I want to thank Mark Kelsey for calling in. Thank you, Mark.
Always my pleasure.
And I want to thank Zaz Hollander for coming in. Thank you, Zaz.
Thanks, everybody. This was fun.
And Terry Snyder for also coming into the studio.
Have a good weekend.
Okay, we'll be back next week with another edition of Valley Edition.
You've been listening to Valley Edition, a weekly panel discussion on current issues in the Matsu Valley, moderated by Mike Malevsky. Valley Edition is a production of Radio Free Palmer, recorded at our studios in Palmer, Alaska. The views and opinions of hosts or guests do not necessarily represent those of Radio Free Palmer, this station, or its underwriters. If you have any comments or questions about this program, email manager@radiofreepalmer.org.